This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another, then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who, has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that he might try you by what he has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and he is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: international reactions follow a terrorist attack that takes the lives of multiple pilgrims in an Iranian shrine. Iran and Moscow tell a UN Security Council session that Western allegations about Russia using Iranian drones is totally untrue. And a new survey says over two-thirds of Britons are cut back on festive spending this year due to the cost of living crisis. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. A terrorist attack on a holy shrine in the Iranian city of Shiraz in Fars province leaves over a dozen people dead. Officials have confirmed that 15 people have died, and the number also includes women and children. Over two dozen others have been injured in the attack at the Shah Cheragh Shrine, which is one of the popular pilgrimage sites in Iran. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility. The gunman shot his way into the shrine through one of the entrances. He then headed to the main compound, where he opened fire at a pilgrimage staff. Officials say that the perpetrator, a non-Iranian national, has been arrested, and the situation is being investigated. Political analyst Sayed Mohsen Abbas believes the attack is yet another desperate attempt by Western powers to destabilize Iran.
Quite clearly, it seems from all the reports so far that this is a particularly Takfiri and Daesh spun attack. Now, we know where the money strings and the puppet strings of the Daesh and Takfiri terrorists go. We know that they go back to the capital, Washington, D.C. They go back to the capitals of Western Europe. It's, first of all, an act of desperation, because it shows how desperate the Zaire Western imperialist powers are now to bring down Iran. They are using the interim period of the JCPOA, if you like, agreement lull before the midterm elections that Joe Biden is facing to try and do everything they can, first of all, to frighten and scare the Islamic government into complying. Secondly, to make the population despondent, I think, through these acts of terrorism, upsetting the law and order, creating sort of violent protests, using the pretext of the false pretext of hijab as a way of trying to create color revolutions in Iran. All of it is a sign of desperation. It's a sign that actually they've run out of ideas. They really don't have anything else other than to copy and paste and repeat what they've done in the past.
Iran's foreign minister has reacted to the terror attack in Shiraz, saying the country will not allow its national security and interests to be toyed with by those claiming to be defenders of human rights. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Tehran has got its hands on the reliable information that shows terrorists and foreign meddlers have created a multi-layered scheme to make the country insecure. He noted that the recent attack unraveled the sinister intentions of those promoting terror and violence in the country. Iran's president expressed his condolences to the families of the pilgrims who were killed or injured in the attack. Ebrahim Raisi warned that the assault will not go unanswered and that Iran's security and law enforcement agencies will teach the perpetrators a lesson. The terror attack on the Holy Shrine of Shah Cheragh in Iran has drawn condemnations from various countries and international entities. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has strongly condemned the attack and called for bringing the perpetrators to justice. According to the UN chief, such acts that target religious sites are especially heinous, although Pakistan's Foreign Office spokesperson and Speaker of the National Assembly have condemned the attack, saying that the people of Pakistan share the grief of Iranian people. Meanwhile, members of the Yemen Supreme Political Council, including Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, has offered his condolences and has said that the crime will only increase in the unity of Iranian people in the face of enemy plans. Similarly, head of Iraq's National Wisdom Coalition, Sayed Ammar al-Hakim, and leader of a resistance movement, Qais Kazali, have condemned the act of terror. Officials say the 30-year-old assailant, a non-Iranian national who has entered the country from a neighboring site, also is now in custody. 3 days of public mourning have been announced in Fars province. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says Tehran has not supplied any weapons for use in the war of Ukraine, either before or after the conflict. Addressing the UN Security Council session, Amir Saeedi Rahbani rejected all accusations by the U.S. and its Western allies that Iran has delivered drones to Russia to be used against Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russia's permanent representative to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, says calls by the West for a probe into the use of drones will set a dangerous precedent. He said such calls are in breach of the UN Charter. He called on the Security Council to condemn the West's actions and defend the Charter. Under the Charter, he said, only the UN Security Council can mandate an investigation and it shall not seek or receive instructions from any government or authority. The U.S. and its Western allies have been pushing the U.N. Secretariat to organize a probe into the matter.
Tehran has once again rejected baseless accusations about Iranian-made drones being used in the Ukraine war. The Islamic Republic's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, has clearly stated that Tehran would not remain indifferent if it is proven that Iranian drones are being used in the war in Ukraine against people. The top Iranian diplomat had previously stated that Tehran and Moscow have defensive cooperation, saying it's not Iran's policy to provide Russia with weapons and drones to be used in Ukraine. Tehran has time and again clearly stated its opposition to war and any escalation of conflict, urging self-restraint on both sides. Iranian officials say the allegations leveled against the country stem from an ongoing Western campaign to pressure the Islamic Republic. Russian officials have echoed similar remarks.
Everything that is now being done on the Iranian track is subordinated to one goal, pressure on this country. And Washington is mobilizing NATO and EU countries for this in support of its position.
Also, the US, EU, and UK have moved to impose sanctions on Iran over the baseless accusations, supporting the notion that the West only wants to put more pressure on Iran. Meanwhile, Britain, France, and Germany have called on the UN to investigate the allegation. But Iran's ambassador to the UN has described the possible probe as illegal within the framework of Resolution 2231. In a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antony Guterres, Amir Saeedi Rahbani argued that the UN arms embargo on Iran mentioned in the resolution has expired in 2020, saying this means no Iranian sale or transfer of weapons or related materials to other countries is ever since subject to the resolution. The Iranian diplomat also urged the international body not to act based on the anti-Iran allegations by Western countries. Meanwhile, Russia had described the claims by the Western states as conspiracy theories, warning the UN against conducting a probe into such allegations.
No arms transfers in violation of Resolution 2231 have been ever conducted by Iran, and no drones were supplied by Iran to Russia for the use in the conflict in Ukraine.
Moscow has warned that it would reassess its cooperation with the world body if it carries out an investigation into the origins of the drones.
Some Western countries have imposed sanctions on the Islamic Republic under the pretext that it is supplying drones and other weapons to Russia. However, Tehran says that the adopted measures are based on misinformation, announcing its preparedness to hold dialogue with Ukraine towards nullification of these allegations. Still, Kiev and its allies refrain from providing evidence to back up their claims or hold talks with Tehran.
Tehran has dismissed accusations by some Western countries and their media outlets that it provided weapons, including drones, to Russia for deployment against Ukraine. Iran's foreign ministry has called the allegations unfounded and made on the basis of misinformation and ill-intentioned presumptions. The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July, with U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleging that Washington had received information indicating that the Islamic Republic was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred drones, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline for use in the war in Ukraine. However, the Pentagon said it could not confirm the transfer of any Iranian weaponry to Russia. Since the very beginning, Iran rejected the claims, with the country's foreign ministry stating Tehran's preparedness to hold dialogue with Ukraine towards nullification of the allegations. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has even proposed a joint meeting between Iranian and Ukrainian military personnel and experts to review battlefield evidence of Iranian drones used by Russia in Ukraine. Despite that, Kyiv and its allies repeated the baseless American narrative without providing any evidence. The US, EU, and UK imposed sanctions against the country. So, if Kyiv and the West are so sure, then why are they reluctant to provide detailed evidence that supports their claims? Plus, while Iran has managed to advance its defensive capabilities despite U.S. sanctions, is Washington using Ukraine as a false pretext to bring the Europeans along in a bid to impose an arms embargo against Iran to hamper the country's progress in the defense sector?
Australia says it will extend its military aid to Ukraine to bolster its position against Russia in the war.
We're mindful that Ukraine needs to now be supported over the longer term if we're going to put Ukraine in a position where it can resolve this conflict on its own terms. And so this charge is very much focused on that, both in terms of making sure that we are helping in a UK-led initiative in respect of training and also extending the line of bushmasters that we will be providing to Ukraine.
Canberra says that it will deploy 70 soldiers to Britain to help Iran and Ukrainian troops there. Also, it will ship 30 more armored vehicles. The latest package takes Australia's support for Ukraine to about $425 million since the conflict began in February. Meanwhile, Canberra has placed sanctions on hundreds of Russian individuals and entities and banned the export of some important ores to Russia. Australia is one of the largest non-NATO contributors to the Ukraine war. Russia has been warning that more military aid to Ukraine will only escalate the conflict. A new survey shows two-thirds of Britons are planning to cut back on festive spending this year amid a worsening cost of living crisis. The survey says about 50% of participants are to cut back on gifts and 46% on eating out. Some 35% are planning to cut back on general socializing and food and drink in homes. The UK cost of living crisis started in 2021, with essential goods and prices increasing faster than household revenues. The result was a sharp fall in real incomes, with inflation running at 10%. UK consumer confidence remains close to its gloomiest on record. Consumers face a tight economic squeeze in the 2023 year after Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt scrapped tax cuts planned by the former Prime Minister Liz Truss. He also scaled back the vast energy support scheme for households. Italy's new Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and her right-leaning government won a vote of confidence in the Senate, going through the same procedure in the lower house on Tuesday. Meloni has presented her program, setting out policy for the full five-year legislative term. Max Civilli reports from Rome.
On Wednesday, Italy's new far-right-led government of Giorgia Meloni won a confidence vote in the Senate with 115 votes in favour, 79 against and 5 abstentions. The new executive can now get down to business. Meloni, aged 45, is the leader and one of the founders of Brothers of Italy, the party that spearheaded a right-wing coalition to victory in Italy last month's election.
Among the many weights I have on my shoulders today is the fact that I am the first woman ever to lead this nation as Prime Minister.
During Tuesday's first speech in the Chamber of Deputies, Meloni had presented a political program which aims as a priority to counter soaring energy bills and a looming recession. Among the main measures to take away are plans to introduce tax cuts, lift limits on cash transactions, taxing the excess profits of the energy giants in a windfall tax, and reallocating some of the EU pandemic recovery funds.
Our priority today must be to curb high energy prices and accelerate in every way the diversification of supply sources and domestic production. The context in which the government will have to act is very complicated, perhaps the most difficult since the World War II.
Also on Wednesday, Meloni went on saying that Italy will remain an active member of the EU on her watch and that it would continue to be a reliable partner of NATO in supporting Ukraine. Italy's new prime minister said that the only way to facilitate a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine is helping Kyiv to defend itself militarily. Meloni's two main allies, media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and League leader Matteo Salvini, are longtime admirers of Russian President Vladimir Putin. U.S. Embassy chargé d'affaires attended in person the confidence vote on Giorgia Meloni's new government at the Chamber of Deputies on Tuesday. Some fear Meloni could embark on a course of confrontation towards the Western alliance. Back in 2016, Meloni defined the European Union as rotten to its core, while in 2014, Italy's new prime minister staunchly opposed sanctions against Russia after its annexation of Crimea.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Analysis of recent events in Iran. In this program, we look at how Western governments have planned to stoke unrest in Iran, doing everything in their power to encourage rioting in the country. Please stay with us. Recent events in Iran have become a pretext for Western governments to interfere in Iran's internal affairs and to pour fuel on the fire of unrest in the country. During the past 43 years, the enemies of the Islamic Revolution have used all opportunities and all means at their disposal to attempt to oust the Islamic Republic. In addition to the policy of promoting Iranophobia, both within the region and the wider world, they have also tried to smear the Islamic Republic, sullying Iran's reputation and portraying a very negative image of Iran through the media outlets that they control. It is obvious that the United States of America, Canada and Britain, and some other European countries are trying to bring about a velvet revolution or a colored revolution in the Islamic Republic, doing everything they can to cause unrest in the country. The enemies of Islam have used all sorts of pretexts and all manner of techniques to create a crisis within the country, including defending women's rights, human rights, how elections are held, the vetting of candidates, and creating doubt with regards to how votes are counted or tallied. Anything which can be used to split the population or create divisions and discord among the people is fair game as far as the enemies of Iran are concerned. All these techniques and many more have been used at some point during the past 43 years to generate unrest within the Islamic Republic. The enemies are constantly watching out for an opportunity to present itself to stoke more riots and demonstrations. They plan meticulously for the next riot in Iran. Virtually all democratic nations face demonstrations and unrest, usually caused by the poor economic performance of their government, or soaring prices and soaring inflation, which outstrip wage increases quite easily, or rising unemployment, etc. But these demonstrations and protests are usually handled quite well and governments respond to the demands of their people. The Islamic Republic of Iran is the most democratic country in the West Asia region. In the first year after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, no less than 5 elections and referendums were held, with the Iranian people casting their ballots in the ballot box at least 5 times in less than a year. The first of these was a national referendum on the type of government and governing system that we should have. The second was a nationwide election to determine the members of the Assembly of Experts of the Constitution. The third was a national referendum on a draft constitution drawn up for the Islamic Republic. The fourth was a nationwide presidential election. And the fifth was a nationwide parliamentary election to elect members of the Iranian parliament, the Majlis. It is worth noting the unprecedented nature of the first referendum in post-Islamic Revolution Iran. In no other revolution in the world's history have the people been asked to vote in a national referendum to determine the type of government and the type of governing system that they should have just 50 days after the victory of the revolution. The democratic credentials of the Islamic Republic are quite clear. In the 43 years which have passed since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, more than 40 nationwide elections have been held in the Islamic Republic. Few countries can match this level of participation by the general public in the running of their country. But it is also worth noting that some of the least democratic countries of the world are also located in West Asia, neighbouring Iran. These dictatorial and totalitarian regimes, many of them absolute monarchies, do not have the support of a majority of their own populations. And yet, they invade Yemen and have killed hundreds of thousands of Yemeni men, women and children with weapons supplied to them largely by the United States of America and Britain. These same ruthless dictatorial regimes, neighbouring Iran, have murdered dissident journalists and have imprisoned political activists and women's rights activists, but so-called defenders of human rights in the West have kept silent on these dreadful crimes. Western governments have failed to condemn these crimes, giving these dictatorial regimes, who happen to be client states of the West, just a simple slap on the wrist. The Islamic Republic of Iran, of course, is treated very differently by the West, which shamelessly pursues double standards in the West Asia region. Britain and the United States, in collaboration with certain dictatorial regimes of West Asia, have established dozens of Persian language broadcasters who air disinformation and lies and give a very biased coverage of events in Iran. Broadcasters like Iran International, BBC Persian, VOA, Voice of America, and Manotor. The purpose of these broadcasts is to cause a rift between the Iranian people and their government and to create unrest in the country. Every pretext is used to stoke tension and unrest within the Islamic Republic. The tragic and untimely death of a young Iranian woman, Mahsa Amini, was used to bring about unrest in the country under the guise of defending women's rights. It is worth noting that an autopsy and coroner's report in relation to the tragic death of this young woman states quite clearly that no acts of violence of any kind have played a part in the death of this young woman. In fact, according to the coroner's report, Mahsa Amini had a history of stroke and heart attacks, and this was what ultimately caused her death after she went into a coma. Concurrent with Mahsa Amini's death in mid-September, a horrific act of terrorism in Kabul, Afghanistan, claimed the lives of dozens of young girls and children. Rather shamefully, not one Western government or Western human rights organization expressed any sympathy or any condolence to the families of the victims of this horrific terrorist attack. This tragedy in Afghanistan apparently went unnoticed by Western governments and Western human rights organizations. However, mainstream Western media, including the Persian language broadcasters which go on air in London, have given maximum media coverage to events in Iran, as usual, putting out misinformation and outright lies and pouring fuel onto the fire of unrest. In just about any country in the world, the police and security forces arrest rioters and those who damage public or government property. Just about every night, police forces throughout Europe arrest rioters and demonstrators who damage public or government property. But when Iranian police and security forces do the same, this is somehow seen as unconventional or something unusual. The Islamic Revolution in Iran triumphed in a two-polar world. We overcame both the East and the West. The Islamic Revolution triumphed with the support of the Iranian people, and this support remains steady and steadfast up until this day.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
years in Syria.
Part 1.
In Syria, I couldn't look the way I wanted to at the passing of 9 years, as I passed the streets, alleyways, and buildings. I could only keep myself composed to some extent, as opposed to many others who were in shock and awe when they encountered these scenes. Especially when I saw all of those factories and workshops that used to be full of workers, engineers, and technicians 9 years ago. People who are no longer in their workplaces. Many people who are no longer with us. There's not enough space in the ground to hide their bodies. Sometimes a park in the street becomes their burial place. I felt that in Syria, I didn't have the right to speak of anything other than the war for the past 9 years. However, I decided to at least look for answers to why all of this happened in Syria. Why Syria? In the United States, people are not very political. Therefore, it really doesn't matter to them what happens in the rest of the world.
So, thank you for your service and thank you what you do for this country. You know, we talk about sacrifice, and we talk about all the things that soldiers do for this great country. And I'm always privileged to be here in this role and stand in front of a formation like this. And you put all of that aside. When our country calls and you answer the call and you go and serve our country in an incredible way and you make incredible sacrifices for the safety of this country. On a national level, we have these components of national power. A couple of them are diplomacy. Another one is economics. You'll hear people talk about, we're gonna give this country a lot of money or we're gonna withhold a lot of money from this country, all in the hopes that we can press forward with what we think as Oklahomans or Americans are important to our country. But every once in a while, diplomacy fails. You're a finite, small group of Americans that will say, I will take that charge, I will take that responsibility, I will raise my hand and go into harm's way for our country. And for that, we should all be grateful.
I'm sure most of the people watching this ceremony were asking themselves, which front line will they fight on to defend the United States? Where are these soldiers going? The answer is West Asia, somewhere in Jordan, specifically the Al-Azraq Air Base. But this is not their final destination. They will actually be deployed to Tanf, which is a US military base in Syria. The arrival of so many forces and so much military hardware comes at a time when the US has officially announced that it intends to draw down its troops in Syria and then withdraw from the country, which is a bit strange.
Even stranger is that the Americans have set up a base in the middle of the desert and have enlarged and equipped it to this extent within 2 years.
CBS News came to this place called Attaf with General Frank McKenzie, commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East.
David, we're standing on the Damascus-Baghdad highway just inside Syria, and what we're doing here is supporting our partners in the fight against ISIS.
However, not all the people here are American. Some members of Syria's opposition visit the TANF base regularly. Apart from their looks and uniforms, they can be recognized by their Arabic language and their Toyota vans. It appears they are opposed to the Syrian government and have come together to fight the Syrian army. But it appears that their main mission after protecting the American base is controlling the roads that pass through TANF. Of course, that's how they describe their mission. But the images of damaged trailers, trucks, suggests their main aim is disrupting the traffic on this trade route so that nothing passes through it, especially trucks carrying goods. The Americans have repeatedly threatened to destroy anything that enters the 50-kilometer radius of the base. What's strange is that this base is built exactly on a route which is the commercial and economic lifeline of Syria. Here, the roads used for transporting goods from the east to Syria. By east, I don't just mean Iraq and Iran. But I mean all countries to the east of Syria, including India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and most importantly, China. For centuries, the Chinese would use what's called the Silk Road to do trade with Europe and Africa. The Silk Road passes through Syria and leads to the Mediterranean Sea and the Black Sea. This way, people in the east could reach the ports of Europe and Africa in the Mediterranean for trade. In fact, compared to shipping by sea, the road can get our goods several times faster and cheaper to 22 countries with 100 ports. Nowadays, the Silk Road is not what it used to be in the past, and much of it is destroyed or replaced. Of course, the Chinese, in cooperation with many other Asian countries, like Iran, intend to revive the Silk Road. This is a decision which is not secret, as they have talked about it openly on many occasions. Till then, the road linking Baghdad to Damascus, and from there to the Mediterranean coast, is still considered as the Silk Road. Now, the Americans have established bases in TANF, right on the main Baghdad-Damascus road, cutting off the Silk Road, and their allied militants don't even allow anyone to enter the base's 35-mile radius. For this reason, when the Iraqis who were in pursuit of ISIS forces entered Syria at the Syrian government's request and unknowingly approached this area, US warplanes would attack them.
Harekâme, harekâme. Yeah, I want to go back to the TANF operation that took place yesterday. Could you confirm that the targeted Shia militias were Iranians or Hezbollah? And do you see any interest, any vital interest to the U.S. and the coalition to control the whole Syrian-Iraqi border?
Let me take a stab at this. At ADTOMF is what you're referring to, the force that moved near ADTOMF. Is that what you're referring to? That was, again, as the chairman pointed out, self-defense of our forces. It was necessitated, sir, by offensive movement with offensive capability of what we believe were Iranian-directed forces. I don't know there were Iranians on the ground.
The U.S. Secretary of Defense had claimed that the Iraqis were encouraged by Iran to make an offensive move. The Iraqis paid a price for the move: U.S. airstrikes. That meant getting close to TANF was treated as an attack on U.S. forces. Thus, U.S. aircraft droplets over the area, warning against approaching the base. That's the reason why American troops came here from more than 9,500 kilometers away. These are the same heroes that were given a warm send-off ceremony by the American people to protect their dignity and interests, and have come here as if they are defending U.S. borders. Although, in some way, they were right. TANF is where the U.S. defends its undisputed dominance over the West. A good thing about Trump is that we don't need to try hard to prove many of our claims about the U.S. anymore.
People want economic freedom.
Iran's a different place.
Is it true that
Iran's no longer thinking about the Mediterranean and going through and...
Trump mentions Iran because he knows many people among Syria's armed opposition rely on the U.S. to counter Iran's regional influence. But it's obvious what Trump means is cutting off eastern economies from the Mediterranean. All right, we said all this to show that the war in Syria is not just about ideology and religion. That's just one reason among many. But before we switch to another puzzle, this question comes to mind. When did they exactly decide to wage a war on Syria? Let's listen to what Wesley Clark has to say. During those years, Clark was the commander of U.S. forces in NATO. He has also run for president several times.
I went through the Pentagon 10 days after 9/11. I couldn't stay away from Mother Army. I went back there to see Don Rumsfeld. I went downstairs. I was leaving the Pentagon, and an officer from the Joint Staff called me into his office and said, I want you to know, he said, sir, we're going to attack Iraq. And I said, why? He said, we don't know. He said, I said, well, did they tie Saddam to 9/11? He said, no. He said, but I guess it's they don't know what to do about terrorism. And so they think, but they can attack states, and they want to look strong. And so I walked out of there pretty upset. And then we attacked Afghanistan. I was pretty happy about that. We should have. And then I came back to the Pentagon about 6 weeks later. I saw the same officer. I said, why haven't we attacked Iraq? We still going to attack Iraq? He said, oh, sir. He says, it's worse than that. He said, he pulled up a piece of paper off his desk. He said, I just got this memo from the Secretary of Defense's office. It says we're going to attack and destroy the governments in seven countries in 5 years. We're going to start with Iraq, and then we're going to move to Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. I said, seven countries in 5 years. I said, is that a classified memo? He said, yes, sir. I said, well, don't show it to me. He was about to show it to me. He said, because I want to talk about it.
Wesley Clark is not the only person who believes the war in Syria was planned long before it started. Many others, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., also share this belief. He is the nephew of the former president of the United States. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is both a lawyer and author, published an article in 2016 in Politico magazine entitled "Why Arabs Don't Want Us in Syria." The article stunned many. He writes, in their view, our war against Bashar Assad did not begin with the peaceful civil protests of the Arab Spring in 2011. Instead, it began in 2000, when Qatar proposed to construct a $10 billion, 1,500-kilometer pipeline through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey. To see whether Kennedy's claims are true or false, we go back to the year 2000. As you are aware, Russia is the biggest producer and exporter of natural gas, with Europe being its biggest customer. The Russians export 70% of their produced natural gas to Europe. This means a steady source of income for the Russians. Russia has been using this as a tool to put pressure on Europe. For example, when European countries in 2009 sided with Ukraine in its price dispute with Russia's gas company Gazprom, the Russians turned off the gas taps in response. All this shows that the Europeans would want to disentangle themselves from this predicament, and the United States would also love to see such a huge source of revenue from its rival Russia. The US is highly motivated as it tries to find an alternative to Russia's gas. As a result, they have turned to Qatar and Azerbaijan for gas. But the fact is that Europe's demand for gas could not be met via sea only, and that such a huge supply could only be sent to the continent through a pipeline. This was where the notion of the Qatari gas pipeline was put forth. That's the same energy transit route that would pass through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Syria, and then reach Europe via Turkish terminals. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. writes, in Putin's view, the Qatar pipeline is a NATO plot to change the status quo, deprive Russia of its only foothold in the Middle East, strangle the Russian economy, and end Russian leverage in the European energy market.
In the limelight.
Democracy is under threat in the US. Even the midterm elections could leave democracy weaker ahead of the 2024 presidential race. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Guardian wrote, Till sat out the 2020 election but appears to have been re-energized by the COVID-19 pandemic. Trump's claim of a stolen presidential election and the January 6th insurrection. Addressing a NatCon convention this time last year, he denounced the incredible derangement of various forms of thought, political life, scientific life, and the sense-making machinery generally in the U.S. Liberal democracy, in his view, had turned the United States government into a dissent-squashing Ministry of Truth working toward a homogenizing, brain-dead, one-world state, a problem to which only right-wing nationalism could provide an all-important corrective. We are close to a total moment, a little dog pulling aside the curtain on the Holy Holies only to find there is nobody there, he told the crowd, adding, We always think of democracy as a good thing, but where do you shift from the wisdom of crowds to the madness of crowds? When does it become a bomb, a racket, a totalitarian lie? Such views might be easy to write off as the eccentricities of a wealthy man, but for the money that Thiel has spent buying influence and supporting like-minded candidates, thanks in large part to a campaign financing system that, while still capping contributions to individual campaigns, allows unlimited funding of nominally outside groups and political action committees. Campaign finance experts see Thiel as a symptom of a much broader problem, a political environment in which a small group of mega donors are growing ever bolder in the size of the checks they write, and the erosion of any nominal firewall between the war chest run by candidates and the funds controlled by outside groups dedicated to their success. Chi-Sun Lee, an expert on campaign finance who directs the Brennan Center's elections and government program at New York University, said, It does seem to be getting worse. Outside spending in this federal midterm cycle is more than double the last midterm cycle. Since Citizens United, just 12 mega donors, 8 of them billionaires, have paid $1 out of every 13 spent in federal elections. And now we are seeing a troubling new trend that some mega donors are sponsoring campaigns that attack the fundamentals of democracy itself. Till's spending has been dwarfed this year by at least three other mega donors. Soros, $128 million to the Democrats. Shipping products tycoon Richard Olhain, $53 million to Republicans. And hedge fund manager Kenneth Griffin, $50 million to Republicans. And Thiel has some way to go to match the consistent giving cycle after cycle of the Koch brothers or Sheldon Adelson, the late Las Vegas casino magnate. Many experts also believe the attack on democracy began long before it became as explicit as Thiel has made it, because the whole point of funneling large amounts of money into the political system is to sway policy away from the will of the majority to the narrow interests of the donors and their friends. This ability to control the policy agenda drives spending even more than the desire to see specific candidates win, says Harvard law professor Lawrence Lessig, whose 2011 book Republic Lost offers an enduringly devastating analysis of the relationship between money and political influence, and the spending is likely only to increase. You're going to see much, much bigger individual contributions and an acceleration of contributions to super PACs, like the ones established to support Vance and Masters, Lessig said, adding, The candidates and the super PACs can't coordinate on spending, but that doesn't mean they can't coordinate on the fundraising. Since the super PACs are outspending candidates by orders of magnitude, it's all a dance to flush money into super PACs. They basically call the shots, and politicians can get anything through that they oppose. Less than a month from the election day, both Vance and Masters are trailing their Democratic opponents in the polls. Vance by less than Masters, but Lessig says it would be wrong to conclude Thiel or any of the other mega donors are wasting their money. If you're a candidate and you know $10 million is going to come in